Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So we're coming up to almost the midpoint of the winter retreat already. I don't know, for some people it may feel it's been a very long time since the retreat started. And for others it may have gone very quickly. It often depends on our experience, doesn't it? Like if it's a difficult, challenging, stressful, confusing time, it can really seem like an eternity. And if it's going smoothly, the practice is easeful and peaceful, and the mind is focused, and there's no distractions, then it can seem very fast. The days and nights pass very quickly, almost a timelessness. So I find that very interesting. Our experience can be so varied and so subjective. And time, of course, is such a fluid thing, concept, really. For myself, it's been quite an atypical retreat time, because partly we weren't here, some of us, Ajahn Ariyasilo and Ajahn Kongrit and myself and, of course, Ajahn Amaro. And most of the nuns were, as you know, in Thailand for a couple of weeks. And I decided to make that part of the winter retreat practice for myself. So for me, that meant to give up anything other than simple meditation practice, walking, sitting, lying down, standing. But of course, we were moving around a lot and we were visiting all these different places. And so that was really interesting. It was a moving winter retreat. And although there's a stillness right here, there was a lot of activity. And I must say, most of it was really inspiring and uplifting for me personally. It was really incredible to spend time in a Buddhist country. I've been to Burma before, but only for a short stay, and I was with my mum at the time. Whereas this trip was with Sangha, with a big group. And that was really beautiful experience to be part of this group of nuns and to share the experience. We were actually spending a lot of our time quite close together. We shared most of our accommodation. I mean, we had like Parnanachat, where we were for at least about a week of the time, good half of the time away. They very kindly gave us a wonderful building to use. It was like a very smart two-story building with a couple of rooms, a couple of like bedrooms, where the more senior nuns stayed. And then there were various sort of hallways and like a big living area on the ground floor. And so we were all just sort of camping out. It was a bit like a tudong, like a collective tudong experience in some ways, except much more luxurious than your average tudong. But it was very communal. It was very shared. And there was no sort of privacy. And that was quite new, I think, for most of us. Most of the time, we're lucky enough, aren't we, to have our own rooms in the monastery. And I know all of you lay support team members also at the moment have your own rooms. At least I think you do. At least the women do. And so to be sort of never alone was quite, for me, a big part of the practice of being away, to be surrounded by people most of the time. But then there was the there was also the wider Sangha, and I was extremely touched by the welcome that we received as Sila Dra. We're a bit of a very small group, and quite a new sort of for many of the Thai people, they don't have nuns like us in Thailand. There's many, many thousands of Meichis, and we were lucky enough to meet quite a few of the Meichi communities, but we're a little bit unusual, and sometimes it's difficult, I could sense, for people to know where to put us or how to treat us. But it was really, I find it really quite awe-inspiring in Thailand. It's not the first time I've been, but this time also, the way that people very calmly and graciously flow with reality. And so we turn up, these rather strange-looking nuns, and immediately people start organizing and finding a way to receive us in a very welcoming and a very generous way. And that really inspired me so much. Like a collective mindfulness en masse. And of course, most of the places we were going to and the people that we met were practicing the precepts, like we've just committed to this evening. There's a real power to that en masse. I felt it, and I felt the incredible mindfulness at Wat Nong Papong when we spent time there. The main reason we were there, of course, being to celebrate the birth anniversary of Lung Po Cha. And so this was there was a huge gathering, as Ajahn Amri mentioned last week, at Wat Nong Papong, over a whole week, actually. But then it culminated on the 16th, his actual death anniversary, in fact. It culminated on that day with many, many thousands of people. And what struck me then was how, again, everybody seemed to find their place in that. And there was this extraordinary kind of, it was a little bit chaotic, but amazingly less chaotic than I would have ever expected. And at one point, as Ajahn mentioned, there was a procession of all the bhikkhus who were present, thousands and thousands of bhikkhus, great sea of ochre in this procession. Everybody seemed to be in the right place somehow. It was a very beautiful, moving sight to see them all streaming out of the Dharma hall. And then the nuns, us and many, many Meichis, the resident Meichis and nuns from all over Thailand, I imagine. Large number of nuns also following on, and then all the lay people were gathered around to observe this procession. And it was just, it was like a beautiful orchestra. It was as if it had been very carefully orchestrated and rehearsed and, you know, organized, but of course it hadn't at all. It was almost a spontaneous. It was an arranged thing, but perhaps for many people like me, it was just go along with it, and to be part of something like that, now gave me a lot of joy. We also had the chance to visit quite a few different monasteries. Ajahn Amri mentioned some of them, and there are many, many small memories I have. Memories like that, isn't it? It's not like I can't remember chronologically everything that happened, but there were small moments that really stood out for me and touched my heart very deeply. One of the best for me was the going to see the Meichi Cow's memorial stupa. She was an Arahant nun, and we had the chance to visit the nunnery, which was right next door to the stupa, and meet a couple of nuns who she had actually practiced with. I found that really rather wonderful. And also there's the kuti that she lived in, and it's been preserved. So we could actually go into the room where she lived, the kind of bedroom area, and all her clothes were still there. I don't know when she died. I can't remember. I don't know, 10, 20 years ago. About 5 years ago. Thank you. So 5 years ago, all these clothes are still there as if she's just walked out of the door. She's coming back soon. And I felt touched by that, keeping that space so that people like us could go along and take inspiration from recollecting her life. And the stupa has a lot of rather beautifully displayed information about her life and her practice and the details of her practice, the salutary details of her experiences as a practitioner and the pitfalls that she faced, because she had a mind that was very bright, you know, very focused. So she experienced many visions and very, how to say, sublime states of mind, and got caught up in the sense that perhaps she'd completed the work, as it were. And it took a very firm and wise teacher to put her straight. And all of this is detailed, and it's moving. It's the senses, you know, we're not, I don't know. What I want to say is we're not so different. We're all practicing, and we can all make mistakes. We can all get caught up, and then we can all overcome our obstacles. And, that was a very lovely experience to go there. We spent quite a lot of time there and missed a couple of other visits we were going to make that day. So we added on an extra day of trips. So the whole 2 weeks was very full. And those trips were to Ajahn Mun's museum and Tat Phanom, which I'd never heard of actually before, which is the spiritual hub of northeast Thailand. Reminded me a little bit of the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya in India. Not quite on the same scale, but it was an amazing atmosphere of respect for the Dharma, respect for the Buddha. The shrine has some relics of the Buddha. It's said to have relics of the Buddha himself. And so people come from far and wide to visit Tat Phanom. We had a chance to do the same. And since coming back from Thailand, getting into retreat mode, it's really interesting to see the difference, in a way how much it's the same. So I was still walking, sitting, standing and lying down, and finding myself then in this environment here at Amravati, in Akuti also, out in the field, cold, windy, beautiful nature, very still. In Thailand, everything's so alive, because even though it's the cold season, it's still pretty hot. And I spend a lot of time watching ants, you know. There's so much activity in the ant world, and not just the ants, but insects abounding. And life, you know, very lush place in where we were staying. A lot of the monasteries we stayed and visited were out in nature and very lush and very forested. Some of the trees at Wat Nong Phapong and at Wat Pai Nanachat are very venerable, ancient, huge trees like I don't see in England very much, if at all, actually, if at all. So the forest, the nature, and the abundance of life over there. But coming back here, the contrast for me is very beautiful, the stillness of the winter and the quietude. The animals having to spend a lot of time in their shelters and foraging and then back to the warm. And we're the same, aren't we? Foraging, coming out for the meal and the breakfast, and then back in the warm. Sort of having to put lots of layers on between sala and lodging. So there was a very lovely, rather stark contrast for the body, for the due to the climate, the difference in the climate. And the stillness here, I mean, it's just extraordinary. It's so conducive to practice. What I noticed for myself was it took me a while to wind down. So I spent a lot of time on the walking path, and that was rather wonderful, particularly the dawn and the sunset, sunrise and sunset. The light, the changing of the light, the slowness of it. In Thailand, the sunset's really fast and rises almost, you hardly notice, it's just up. But here, the long, drawn-out, colourful, really very beautiful times of day for me, very still, very present. And so I was getting into retreat mode, and then dear Ajahn Bodhipala got unwell. She got sick, so we've been in and out of hospital for the last few days since Sunday. She's fortunately doing really well now, and she should be back tomorrow. But it's been quite a journey for her at the age of 77 to have emergency surgery. Fortunately, she wasn't in a lot of pain, but simply the suddenness of it, the unexpectedness of it, and then the move from a kuti into a very busy and eventful space. In the casualty, first of all, and then on the surgical ward. The ward she's on is an acute surgical ward, so there are people coming and going every day. Operations happening, mostly for people unexpectedly, and the staff running around. So busy. Wonderful staff, very kind, but extremely busy. And Ajahn's been a kind of fount of Dharma teachings. Every time we go and visit her, she shares with us her experience, and it's really very profound. And the sense of not knowing what was happening, going into the operating theatre and not really knowing if she was going to come out, thinking probably she would, but not sure. And so to even be, you know, in a proximity to sickness, aging, death, it's really powerful, isn't it? We had Ajahn Anando's mum's funeral yesterday also, going to her funeral, a very beautiful funeral service in a Catholic church, with a priest who knew her very well, which was rather wonderful. He'd been visiting her every week for about the last, 4 or 5 years, and helping her to make use of her time, good use of her time. And then we went to the graveside. Maureen's buried. She's been buried very close to where she lived, in a very beautiful field, Chorley Wood. And so we saw undertakers lowering the grave into the ground. Erica was there, Bethany, myself, a couple of monks. Of course, Ajahn Anando. And we were able to do some chanting, funeral chanting. The Buddhist part of the ceremony could happen there, out in nature, under the sky. And wasn't it the most beautiful day yesterday? It was a really clear sky, bright sun, chill, fresh. Freshness in the air. It was a lovely day for us to celebrate Maureen. I spent lots of time with Maureen over the years, and so I was able again to see this process, her process of slowly letting go of life and dealing with so many different vicissitudes, both physical and also her sort of life situation. And she was a real inspiration to me, because she wasn't a Buddhist, but I would say she was a spiritual lady. And she had above all a great patience, great patience, great endurance. So whenever I'd go and see her, however she felt, and sometimes she felt really, really rough. She had emphysema and a number of other difficult issues physically, and it was difficult, it was hard for her. But however she felt, she always gave me a very warm welcome. And she was always extremely gracious and kind. So that was a good example for me. We were very fortunate while we were away to receive copies of a book on the life of Ajahn Chah, which has been written by Ajahn Jayasaro. It's a huge tome. It's absolutely magnificent book. Various chapters, various sections. Starting with a wondrous description of Ajahn Chah's funeral. Ajahn Arisilo was there, I know. And he tells of how the funeral pyre got a bit out of hand. And the fire spread. And it was obviously quite an amazing occasion. And reading this book, I'm really taking in the teachings of Ajahn Chah, more than the details of his life, really, his teachings and his approach, and the sense of him being a very, very strict, very firm teacher, somebody who his disciples were quite intimidated by, perhaps. Certainly, they'd know where he was. And the sense of quite powerful sense of discipline and tough practice, people really being pushed and exerting themselves strenuously in their practice. And and then a gradual softening as he got older. Not a lot of softening, but just a slight softening as he got older. And so many stories, so many, more than anything for me, a sense of how it may have been to be a disciple of Ajahn Chah. I've never really connected with Ajahn Chah, even though I've heard many times about him from people who knew him and trained with him. And yet this year I've benefited from this opportunity to actually have some sense of a deeper connection through the time in Thailand, and also reading this book, which I believe it took Ajahn Jayasaro many years to put together. It's been a life work, and it really is a great contribution, you know. I've been taking in the concept of mine and uncertainty. When Ajahn Chah, in the last sort of 5 or 6 years of his life as a teacher, before he became too sick to be able to teach anymore verbally, he gave many, many talks where apparently were using this concept, mine, which is really a way of describing the characteristic of anicca, as I understand it, impermanence. But mine in Thai is a word that's very commonly used, a colloquial, common term, and just means not sure, can't be sure, it's uncertain. So it's a figure of speech that would be very familiar to Thai speakers, as I understand it. And so Ajahn Chah brought this in and used it to help to explain the reality of change. Reflecting back over My time that I've known Ajahn Anando's mother, that I've known Maureen, and also other friends and sisters and brothers who I've lived with over the years. I've been really reflecting on this over the retreat, because I don't know about you, but during retreats I always find I sort of go through my whole life story. It's actually quite boring, you know, after, you know, it's not that exciting, but somehow the mind seems to need to do that. It sort of dredges up, you know, everything, it seems to me. I sort of go through all the years of my life and then I can stop, you know, once I've got to the end of it, sort of thing. But that seems to be the first thing that happens. But I've been very grateful for it actually this time, because what I'm really seeing is how much everybody changes, and just seeing the aging process for all of us. And it's really a sense of the commonality, the sense of that we're all in it together. You know, we're all on this journey, which doesn't really have a happy ending in a way. And it's the strange thing to me about our life story, our life trajectory, is that it starts off quite bright and rosy in a way. Ajahn Anando spoke at his mother's funeral about his childhood and how for the first 5 years of his life, he was living in a golden realm, because he had this person who was his mother, Maureen, there for him, you know, looking after him. And I had a similar sort of experience of being a child. It was just heaven, you know. Everything's provided for you. You've got nice people around you who love you, and they want the best for you, and you're totally protected. I know that's not the story for everybody. There can be the whole range, the whole spectrum, from the most pleasant to the most horrendous. But, you know, childhood, there's a sense of an innocence. We don't have to go to work. We don't have to think about money, pensions, tax returns, worry about this, worry about that. We don't have to struggle in those ways. It's a very spacious time. I can remember as a child, I had no real sense of time. It was endless. A day was an enormous, vast expanse, as I recall it. It was fabulous in that sense. And then we, you know, we get a bit older and puberty sets in, and, you know, for me that was torture. You know, suddenly having to do lots of exams and to have this body that was, you know, turning into an adult body was absolutely, to me, it was horrendous. It was disturbing, deeply disturbing, and moody, irritable, rebellious, you know, all these sorts of energies start to come in. Confusing, above all, perhaps. You know, and then we come into, you know, choosing careers and life paths. If you're really lucky, someone like Ajahn Amaru, you're very young, you decide to become a monk or a nun. That's exceptional. I know most of us have had a bit more of a complicated journey before letting go of the worldly life, those of us in robes, or before becoming a practitioner, before aligning ourselves with the Dharma. For me, it was a, you know, time of seeking direction and not knowing where to look, how to find the way forward. Anyhow, then we, you know, speaking really more in terms of the body, in terms of the life story physically, then we begin, you know, to notice the decline of the body and the stiffness in the joints, or the, you know, the sort of less energy, less resilience, more prone to sickness. And we don't know, we never know what's coming next, really, do we? After a certain age, you wake up in the morning, you never quite know how it's going to be, whether the body's going to be flexible or whether it's going to be stiff and painful, which you don't know. And slowly but surely gaining patience with that and coming to terms with that. I think if we're lucky, we get to live to old age and we have a chance to learn from each and every ache and pain and the blows that we receive when we have some sort of sickness, some sort of disease, some sort of difficult diagnosis or treatments to go through. We're lucky, really, aren't we? Because then we have a chance to grow, to learn through those things. But the trajectory of our life is downhill, from the word go. It's curious. It's really quite amazing to me. The cause of death, of course, is birth. We love birth. We want birth. We seek birth constantly, really. But then the ultimate, the outcome of that, the end point, the result is old age, sickness and death. Not just speaking about the body in any sense. This is the way. Every birth has a death. And so I'm really grateful to all the people that I know, including myself, actually, aging and changing and essentially decaying and breaking down. I'm grateful for that because it's a bringing home the end result of birth. Birth, it brings this sense of excitement, there's an enthusiasm. When a baby's born, you know, I really loved, I used to be a doctor, and one of my favorite things was obstetrics, where the babies are being born, and you get to be a part of that. It was awful when things went wrong, then it was probably about the worst job. But when things went well, It was really lovely to be a witness, to be a part of birth. Everyone's happy, rejoicing. It's wonderful. The energy, the sense of celebration. It's profound. It's beautiful. And then when it comes time, you know, we get the cancer diagnosis or the sudden stroke or the heart attack or the emergency, we're in trouble. How that feels? Shock. Dear friend of ours of the Sangha who died in a car accident in November. And I Ajahn Sundra came and told me about it. I heard from her about it. This car accident, one minute this lady was alive and well, and the next minute she was dead. And I felt it like a shock wave, you know, like a tremor set in. I went cold. My belly, my inside of me, I felt cold like ice when I heard the news, and then everything was shaking through, like a total trauma. And you know, and then death when it comes. Who knows? I mean, I don't obviously know what that is like. I haven't had any kind of a near-death experience. Some of you may have done. I've witnessed many deaths, and I know it's not easy, generally. It's really not easy. For most people, it's very difficult. Very difficult to let go. And so I'm very interested in death and dying, and I feel very blessed to have witnessed people dying and to be able to come back to that and to contemplate that again and again. As the Buddha suggested to us, to contemplate the death of the body, the changes that the body undergoes after death, and to consider the death of this body, our bodies, now, to do it now, to bring that to mind. In a sense, it's a kind of an imagination, and yet it is the way things are going to happen. And so to bring ourselves to that place and to really, really consider, he said, every day. In the Tibetan tradition, this is what they do every day. And my sense is from the Satipatthana Sutta, there's an exhortation for us to bring this to mind constantly. The full circle of life. Not to fixate on any particular part of it, but to see the fullness, the totality of it. Maine is constantly changing and uncertain. After Kathy died in this car accident, this friend was killed in this car accident, that really, really brought the uncertainty, the vulnerability, the unpredictability of this life home to me, like really brought it home. And how we're all connected, how each experience of each person can impact all of us, how we can benefit from that. You know, I feel that like with my parents, I'm particularly close to them, of course, and like seeing them going through the aging process and dealing with many different difficulties, sicknesses, fears and concerns. It's like that's very close to home. It's wonderful. It's like they're my teachers. The Devadutta right there. And so it's a mixture for me of a sort of, there's a sort of, there's pain, there's suffering, there's a feeling of challenge around our human predicament. But also it's a real call, I find, to rise up and to open the eyes, you know, open the heart and really examine it, examine the situation that we find ourselves in. Maine, just one breath at a time. Here we are, here it is. And what I find very apparent, very striking, is that the more I really dwell in uncertainty, not knowing, in observing the change in nature, in this body, in the people around me, the uncertainty of who's going to get sick next, what's going to happen, who knows what might happen tomorrow to any of us. Or out in the wider world, who knows what might happen. You know, the more I dwell in this and really move close to this reality, let it really inform me, yeah, then the more clear the sense of the impersonal becomes, the anatta characteristic. You know, they so inform and mirror one another. The change, the impermanence, and then yes, of course. So how can we hold on to anything? How can we make anything important? How can we believe that there's anything here that belongs to me? That I can rely upon as mine, myself? And just as when Ajahn Bodhipala had to rush off to hospital, you know, all her clothes and possessions, everything just left. And the body's just taken away, pretty much. So it is, you know. How can I hold on to these possessions? They're not going to be with me for very long. And I could lose them any minute, any moment. So why worry about them? Why be concerned? And then, of course, the khanda, the five khanda, the five heaps of stuff that we know to be, that we experience as our reality, as our world, this body, feeling in the body, our perceptions, our ideas, thoughts, beliefs, memories, what we think is right and what we think is wrong, sankhara, mental formations, and the consciousness itself, all of it, you know, the input, what I see, what I hear, taste, smell, touch, what I know, what I am, you know, all of that is not to be relied upon. I can't hold on to any of that. That could leave any time. That could change. That could disappear. That will change. That is changing. It is disappearing. It's disappearing even as I speak, even every moment. It's gone. And something else comes. It's like that. There's no continuity whatsoever. And in a way, that's a great relief. I feel it is a great relief, you know, to come to that place. I call it in the zone. Once I'm in the zone, I sort of know. You see, another Thai word I picked up while we were away was pordi. I really like this word, pordi. I'd never heard it before. It means basically something like, how would you say Ajahn Congruent? Good enough. Thank you. Like, good enough. It's okay. It's okay. It's good enough. This poor D, for me, I can relate to as when the practice is when I've let go of any sense of continuity from moment to moment, any sense of me-ness, my-ness, myself, that. And that's not so difficult, is it, really? Because it's simply the willingness to stop and to bring the attention inward and to take our object of meditation, whatever it is, or even if we don't have an object of meditation, to stop and to be aware of this moment. Knowing then, you know, as soon as we're in that zone, poor D, you know, that's enough. That's all there is. That's it. There's nothing else. There's nothing else to seek. There's nothing to reject. There's nowhere to go. Nothing to do. As I call it, in the zone, we're there. We're practicing well. And it takes that certain amount of renunciation, letting go of the input, you know, consciously, you know, reining it in, you know, seeking any kind of, I would say, entertainment. Letting that go, letting go of the sights, the smells, the sounds, taste, touch, thinking, to be willing to stop. And of course, this is what retreat is all about. It's the opportunity. It's all set up for us here. We have the encouragement. We have the situation. It couldn't be better. Thanks to the people who've come to support us. the lay support team, make it possible for the monastic Sangha to basically stop. Pretty much, I hope, most of us have a chance to really stop, to let go. All the things we have held as responsibilities, as things we have to think about, things we have to do, watching them fade into the background and simply being present now. Poor D, everything then is very fine. And from that perspective, of course, change is obvious. And it's okay. From that perspective, for me, the dread, uncertainty, unpredictability, volatility of our lives all makes sense. It's like, yes, of course. It's all a call to stop. It's begging us to stop. Every time there's a fear, a worry, a concern, some dreaded future event or some miserable memory of the past, you know, coming into the mind, there is the call. There's the encouragement right there to stop. Come back. Present moment awareness, whether it's watching the breath or feeling the body or no particular object, simply here, you know, to come back is to know the beauty, even for me, the beauty of these characteristics of maine, of anicca, of change, of anatta, of not self. Pudi, it's all good. It's all very fine. Everything is in the right place when the mind is centered. For me, it's a bit like a wheel. I have this image that comes to my mind. When I start thinking, I start worrying about this or that, or I'm spinning back into the past. It is just like a wheel. It's like getting to the rim of that wheel, you know, and it's spinning fast. And it's agitating, it's disturbing, it's breath, you know, get sort of takes my breath away, you know. Spinning. Ajahn Sumedho once described the mind that isn't centered as like a whirling vortex. I love that. Well, yeah, that's absolutely what it's like. It's like the storm, you know, the hurricane. And the more I believe or identify with the experience, the more it's like going to the periphery of that storm where the wind is really fast, whirling us around. Whirling vortex. But all it takes is the, you know, that willingness to stop. To let go of distraction and to focus, come home, come back. For me, it's the breath. I've almost always, I find myself practicing Anapanasati. That's just an example, to pay attention to the breath, to come back to the breath. It could be anything, but it's certainly helpful to pay attention to the body, to have some focus on this physical form, and to come back, because it's always when we're paying attention to the breath, paying attention to the body, it's always now, of course, isn't it? We're badikarato. Ajahn Buddhadasa gave a beautiful talk. There's a book of this talk he gave about the Badikarata Sutta. One single excellent night is one way of translating this title. And he said, you know, we can all be, we all should be, let us all be, badikarato, enjoyers of a single excellent night, enjoyers of the present moment. The present moment, he said, the Buddha said, this is the one fortunate attachment we can have. It's worth glomming on to this one. Really making much of this one. And it's the same thing I'm saying, whether it's watching the breath or the body. It's the present moment awareness. And then the whirling vortex resolves itself. The image I've had lately, the spinning wheel, it's like coming from the outer rim of the wheel, the mind slowly but surely moves in towards the center. And what's happening there? Right in the heart of it, right in the center of the storm, the still point. And it's always, always available to us. It's available to us in each and every moment. And I, for one, really celebrate the fact that we have this glorious time of winter retreat to be able to keep moving towards the still point, to live at the still point, to come to that place of timelessness. It's a place of no change, but from which vantage point all the reality of samsara is our teacher. Every piece of nature, both within and without, it's teaching us. It's revealing the Dharma. It's showing us the truth. From that place, we look around us, and actually even the sense doors then become our friends and allies, because everything we hear, see, smell, taste, touch is teaching us. It's showing us. It's revealing these characteristics, change, not self, and we can let go. Then we can let go, endlessly let go, and stay steady and stay still and watch the whole world reveal itself to us. So I wish you a very blessed time, these next weeks of precious practice time. And equally for the lay support team, that your great help and support brings tremendous fruit, and also that you have a sense of a really spacious retreat time too. Many hours in the day when we can let go, we can stop, we can drop everything, and we can practice very single-mindedly. Thank you very much for listening.